Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Well, Knight, my boy, now that it's finished, I just called you in to tell you I think you've done a fine job.
Adolf Knipe stood in front of Mr. Boland's desk. There seemed to be no enthusiasm in him at all.
Well, aren't you pleased?
Oh, yes, Mr. Boland. Did you see what the paper said this morning?
No, sir, I didn't.
The man behind the desk pulled a folded newspaper towards him and began to read. The building of the great automatic computing engine ordered by the government some time ago is now complete. It is probably the fastest electronic calculating machine in the world today. Its function is to satisfy the ever-increasing need of science, industry, and administration for rapid mathematical calculation, which, in the past, by traditional methods, would have been physically impossible, or would have required more time than the problems justified. For practical purposes, there is no limit to what it can do.
No limit? Can it make me feel joy again?
There are no limits to what the great automatic computing engine can do. And that includes, yes, the ability to know at any given moment what will bring you joy.
Yay!
And this printout here, I've got it, just says dog and sunglasses.
Look at him go. Oh, it's true.
That reading that we heard at the top was the opening to The Great Automatic Grammatizator by Roald Dahl. Folks, welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We are broadcasting exclusively on Patreon. Who's that reader?
Why, that was Doug Raffini making his debut on the show. Doug's a musician and an old friend of Heather's who she used to go see him in the band Judge Nothing. He's still making music with his band Pet Lover. And he's a really great composer. If folks are looking for commercial compositions of various genres, don't even think about using that computer-generated music. Go with a real human musician like Doug Raffini. I'll link out to his site in the show notes. Thank you, Doug.
This story we're doing today is The Great Automatic Grammatizator. It's from a collection of short stories called Someone Like You, published in 1953.
Back at the dawn of 2023, when we weren't sure how to finish out this month of Roald Dahl fiction, we got a comment from listener Cole Karen on our Lamb to the Slaughter episode, which read, a more science fiction-y Dahl story that you might want to cover might be The Great Automatic Grammatizator, in which an inventor creates a machine that can write an award-winning novel in 15 minutes. Naturally, a writer as darkly comic as Dahl is going to have some fun thoughts on how this machine would impact the field of publishing. I was intrigued by this synopsis. I read the story, and it's very good. It's a very good story, although Cole did reveal the basic conceit there. That's fine, because this story is really more about the conversation that it sparks than the text itself, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In this era of AI art and chat bots that are writing college papers, it seemed like a prescient story. So thank you for the recommendation, Cole. Let's talk about what happens in this thing.
Our story begins with a fella, Mr. Boland. He's talking to a guy on his staff, a younger fella by the name of Adolf Knipe. Adolf doesn't seem very impressed with this technological wonder that Mr. Boland is showing off.
He's not just showing it off. This is something that Knipe helped him create.
Yes.
And Mr. Boland has brought him in to give him credit where credit is due. He's saying, I don't think I have to remind you that your own contribution, especially to the original plans, was an important one. In fact, I might go so far as to say that without you and some of your ideas, this project might still be on the drawing boards today. It's a computer, supercomputer of some kind for the 50s. I'm sure it would have been a wall with a ton of reel-to-reel tapes on it. But Knipe, that's Knipe with a K, seems not to care about the praise he's receiving. He and Mr. Boland don't even seem to have high opinions of each other. Knipe watches his boss and it says he watched the two small white hands of his chief, the nervous fingers playing with a paperclip, unbending it, straightening out the hairpin curves. He didn't like the man's hands. He didn't like his face either, with the tiny mouth and the narrow purple-colored lips. It was unpleasant, the way only the lower lip moved when he talked. I like that characterization because it's one of those things where I immediately started doing it, you know, while I was reading the...
When you're talking.
Yeah.
Just moving your bottom lip.
Trying to make, just trying to say something with just that lip. Boland doesn't like Knipe either, but in a sort of frustrated fatherly way, it says the older man waited, watching this tall, thin person who stood so sloppily before him. He was a difficult boy. Why couldn't he stand up straight? Always drooping and untidy with spots on his jacket and hair falling all over his face.
So Mr. Boland thinks that maybe Knipe needs a holiday after all of his hard work on this machine. So he kind of forces him to take 2 weeks off. Knipe accepts this vacation. He goes home. He's feeling down, not because of women, which is what men his age would be sad about. No, Adolf is writing a story.
He's a frustrated writer. That's what it was all about, with the spots on his jacket and the droopy hair.
His typewriter is there with a paper and in it, and it says A Narrow Escape. So that's the title of his short story.
Yeah, and it gives you a little sample of it. It's very boilerplate, kind of bad pulpy stuff. That whole preceding scene was put into context when it's revealed that this is what he really wants to be doing. It's not really the point of the story, this dual life that Knipe leads, but it was a specific kind of frustration that was illuminated in that scene, which was being reluctantly good at your job. For writers and artists, this is a definite pose, but I think anybody can relate who's had something they've thought of as a temp job or a day job that you're showing up to every day, but you'd rather be doing something else. When you get praise for that job that you maybe in some way think is beneath you, you know, it's painful in a way.
Like managing a New Age bookstore.
Oh, right. Like you managed, exactly.
I kept getting promoted.
You're so good at this, Chris. I could see you really moving up to district manager of selling crystals.
Oh, God.
That hurt, huh?
Yeah.
Why does it hurt? Why does it hurt to get that praise at the day job? I mean, you probably were doing a good job.
Yeah, you don't want to be doing it, though. You've
right.
got aspirations. You got the... It's time there that you're not enjoying, but
yeah.
it's you're doing what you're supposed to do, which is what a job is. So
I also think that there's something a little superstitious about it where you think there's only a limited amount of praise you're going to get in your life and you don't want it to be for this. Don't do that, because yeah. then it makes you suspect in your mind. You go, maybe this is what I'm cut out to do.
Oh, yeah. I think that's what it is. That's the creeping thought that goes in the back of your mind.
Well, this guy, it's funny because the thing he does do for a day job is actually kind of genius. I mean, he's like a computer programmer.
Uh-huh.
But for him, it's not what he wants to be doing. He wants to be writing those stories. And as you can tell from the little excerpt that's in there... Maybe he's not that great at it.
The story he's writing isn't going very well, and Adolf thinks to himself, to hell with Mr. Bolin and his stupid machine. But then he thinks about the machine, it pauses, and it gives him an idea. He thinks English grammar is governed by rules that are almost mathematical in their strictness. With a few changes, Mr. Bolin's computer could write.
And at first I was like, well, that's a little shaky. Yeah, there are grammatical rules, but that doesn't mean you could probably construct coherent sentences, but it doesn't necessarily lead to human-like storytelling. But Dahl does walk us toward how this could, and in fact does work. It says he found himself almost immediately up against the old truth that a machine, however ingenious, is incapable of original thought. It can handle no problems except those that resolve themselves into mathematical terms. A machine cannot have a brain. On the other hand, it can have a memory, can it not? Would it not be possible on this principle to build a memory section of almost unlimited size? This machine is essentially going to digitize all writing and be able to scan it so that it can create what looks new based on combining older things.
Fairly prescient, this whole story.
Yeah.
Now, Adolf starts working on this idea. He's doing calculations. He's taking extracts from a thesaurus. He's working out how this machine would be built using punch cards and switches and all types of mechanical functions.
Right. He's getting all the language stuff going, but he's also fed in a long list of character names, character types, also quote the plots of stories curiously broken up and subdivided, which means that there's a kind of story super grammar going on. He's feeding in the Blake Snyder Save the Cat thing. He's feeding in some Sid Field screenwriting books. He's feeding in, he probably got that, you know, our comments show last week where the our listener broke down the Terry Pratchett story. He's feeding that in there. All sorts of structural input to this thing as well.
After 15 days of work, Adolf goes into the office. He puts down a huge pile of papers on Mr. Bolin's desk and explains everything. Bolin thinks Adolf is off his nut, but he's very valuable, so he humors him a bit.
This executive has zero idea about writing or that business. He just doesn't at all see the practical use of a writing machine.
Bolin says Adolf is brilliant to be able to build such a machine, but how can you make money on it? Who wants a story written by a machine? And Adolf explains that he's not very happy with his job, and he always wanted to be a writer. And he confesses that he's written hundreds of stories over the last 10 years, 566 to be precise. But nobody wants to buy them.
An important bit of dialogue here. Good heavens, man, what on earth did you do that for? All I know, sir, is I have the urge. What sort of urge? The creative urge, Mr. Bolin.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Bolin tells Adolf, well, it sounds like the experts have spoken. Time to get back to real work. But Adolf, he's not dissuaded. It says, I've made a study of magazines, and it seems that each one tends to have its own particular type of story. The writers, the successful ones, know this, and they write accordingly. So you see, on my machine, by having an adjustable coordinator between the plot memory section and the word memory section, I am able to produce any type of story I desire simply by pressing the required button. Bolin says, look, you can't make any money off this stuff. But Aloff tells him each story can sell for around $1,000. That gets Boland's attention. With a few tweaks, they could be making $40,000 a week. They could corner the market.
Boland can't believe it. You mean to sit there and tell me that these magazines pay out money like that to a man for scribbling off a story? Good heavens, Knipe. Whatever next, writers must all be millionaires. I love that outside perspective. It's cool that it illuminates that. And I think I've mentioned it before, but I worked with somebody, and this was in Los Angeles too,
yeah,
who just thought that the actors in movies made that dialogue up. Because yeah, it was just so outside of what that person's interested in that, of course, you know, no big deal. This boss is exactly like that. Wow, writers make money at that?
So Adolf thinks, how could writers compete with a machine? A machine that could put out 5,000-word story in 30 seconds.
Well, nowadays, Mr. Boland, the handmade article hasn't a hope. It can't possibly compete with mass production, especially in this country. You know that. Carpets, chairs, shoes, bricks, crockery, anything you like to mention, they're all made by machinery now. The quality may be inferior, but that doesn't matter. It's the cost of production that counts. And stories, well, they're just another product, like carpets and chairs. No one cares how you produce them, so long as you deliver the goods. We'll sell them wholesale, Mr. Boland. We'll undercut every writer in the country. We'll corner the market.
Woo!
So he's presenting the idea that story is a commodity and that they could produce so much that they could afford to charge even half of what a human writer charges and still overwhelm the market. Listen, Mr. Boland, who on earth is going to want custom-made stories when they can get the other kind at half the price? It stands to reason, doesn't it? And how will you sell them? Who will you say has written them? We'll set up our own literary agency and we'll distribute them through that, and we'll invent all the names we want for the writers.
I have to admit, when I was reading this, my jaw was kind of on the floor. Now, Adolf suggests that they could put Boland's name on some of the better stories, which of course plays into his ego.
And here we're introducing the idea that if you own the technology, you can also take credit for its product.
Yeah.
How as a culture, you know, sometimes we might think somebody's a genius when in fact they just own something that is innovative, mm-hmm, that's yeah, the product of other geniuses or simply the product of other, you know, a team of determined people,
yes,
a collective. Mm-hmm. But to be able to take credit for something, that's very intoxicating.
Now, Boland asks about plots. How could a machine come up with plots? Aloff says, no problem. I've got a folder full of plots, and it goes into the plot memory section of the machine, and it can do writer tricks. It says, for example, there's a trick that nearly every writer uses of inserting at least one long, obscure word into each story that makes the reader think that the man is very wise and clever. So I have a machine do the same thing. There'll be a whole stack of long words stored away just for this purpose. Where? In the word memory section, he said, apexegetically. And that means, and the addition of a word to clarify meaning, which of course is the joke.
The joke, yes, because it's a huge, apexegetically is a huge word I've never heard before.
Yeah.
It's a great joke for him to insert here, but also a little creepy because it suggests that this story you're reading right now is a computer-generated story.
I'm feeling a little frightened right now, so I'm going to continue.
I'm so scared.
They decide to keep the device secret and have Knipe work on it. 6 months later, they have a machine. It's hidden in another section of the building, and Knipe and Boland stand at the machine. There's lots of buttons, each labeled with different magazines.
I think Roald Dahl was getting ready to go to the comic book convention because this is steampunk as when he shows up with this machine. It's not just a computer terminal where you type in the inputs. It's not a laptop. This story machine is a literal machine with knobs and levers and typewriters attached.
Boland presses the button that's labeled Today's Woman, which is a magazine. The machine does its business, and then out comes gibberish. And he's like, what is this? It doesn't work. And Knipe convinces Boland to give him some more time to fix it. A few days later, another test. After a few more adjustments, the machine is working perfectly. The first story is about a boy who wanted to get his boss's daughter to like him, so he stages a holdup.
It's sort of a boilerplate plot for a women's magazine, almost mm-hmm, like the plots of those Hallmark movies or something.
Yes.
There's almost a comfort in knowing what to expect from them. So this might work.
Boland isn't super impressed, but Knipe is. He runs off 6 more stories, one of which is really dirty for some reason.
Isn't that something that happens with AI chatbots and things?
Yeah.
They become super racist after scanning the web.
Yeah. Now, Knipe puts his name on some of the stories, and Boland's on one of them. The stories are accepted, except for one. The magazine said it wasn't quite right, but it wants to see more of his stuff. So Knipe runs off another story and sends it away,
emphasizing that it's really the ability to generate a lot of this stuff that's going to win the day.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but at this part, I used to do this thing. Well, you were with me on a lot of this stuff, too, where you'd get a meeting based on something you wrote.
Yep.
And you'd go to the meeting thinking maybe they were going to help you produce that thing, and they didn't want it.
No.
They wanted something like it. So yeah. They would say, I really like what you're doing. For some reason, they didn't want to touch the thing that was already done. They want to be on the ground floor of something.
Yeah.
If I'd have been able to walk away from that meeting, feed that script into a machine and have it print out something that was just like it,
uh-huh.
and then gone back to that person within the week, I would have gotten some of those jobs.
Yeah.
It's just that when they wanted something else, I didn't have it because it takes 18 months to put one of these things together.
Of
you
course.
Know? Yeah. So these might be somewhat flavorless stories, but you can flood the inboxes with them.
Yes.
And you can catch up with the editors with them. And if they're hitting the marks for what that magazine needs, they're just going to get in there eventually.
Yep.
You know, when we read some stories, if I can read them in the original Weird Tales, I do. Those magazines are full of boilerplate, templated Weird Tales stories that aren't very good, but they hit all the marks.
Yeah.
And then if you get that access and you sell enough, then there's that success myth that builds around the creator.
It's a very frustrating process. And if you had a machine that could, because it's a numbers game, just like anything, you know, a little bit of luck, a little bit of knowing the right person.
Sure.
But if you're out shotgunning a whole slew of stories, somebody's going to eventually publish one of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you have a machine that can put one out every couple of minutes of every genre, you're in good shape.
Now, the money starts pouring in. In 6 months, they're selling 30 stories a week. Knipe is making up new authors as well.
I've done this deception actually with internet writing where, I worked for a site that was putting out headlines and putting out articles based on whatever the news of the day was, health news. And I had to write several a day, so I would use other pseudonyms in order to mask that it was all coming from one source.
Right.
But those things too, you had a special, and this is the same with search engines. And organic writing where you have certain keywords you want to get a certain number of times. So you get a sheet and it says, use these words this many times, put this in your headline so that you get listed higher, blah, blah, blah. So there's already a computer component to what I was then doing. I bet now that's all AI driven.
Yeah.
Probably there's a human editor that now reviews that to make corrections and humanize it.
Yeah, just recently, I sent this to you. I typed into the chatbot, the one that everybody's going nuts about right now. I said, write a script for the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Yeah.
And it did. It didn't know that it was you and me. It wasn't that clever.
Right.
But it just had the host and the guest. It was cohesive and it was about Lovecraft and it was about Lovecraft stories. I mean, it was good enough that it sounded like something somebody really wrote. It wasn't weird. It didn't have zany sentences. You know, those AI made scripts where people previously a few years ago, you would laugh at them. And a few people took those scripts and made them into movies and they were silly because they didn't make any sense.
Right. They sound like bad translations or something.
Right. This made complete sense. It wasn't interesting. It didn't push any boundaries, but it seemed real.
Yeah, I read it. Made me cry a little.
So Boland wants more. He tells Knipe to set the machine to write novels. People thinking Boland has been writing this stuff keep asking him for a novel.
He's getting swept up in the romance of the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
I love the character of this businessman becoming the great novelist. It's a fun journey for that guy.
After a few months, Knipe has modified the machine to do novels. There are options on this novel device.
First, by depressing one of the series of master buttons, the writer made his primary decision. Historical, satirical, philosophical, political, romantic, erotic, humorous, or straight. Then, from the second row, the basic buttons, he chose his theme. Army life, pioneer days, Civil War, World War, racial problem, Wild West, country life, childhood memories, seafaring, the sea bottom, and many, many more. The third row of buttons gave a choice of literary style. Classical, whimsical, racy, Hemingway, Faulkner, Joyce, feminine, etc. The fourth row was for characters, the fifth for wordage, and so on and so on. 10 long rows of pre-selector buttons.
It's so funny because without having read this or knowing anything about the story, what was the first thing I was talking about this month? Before we even got into Lamb to the Slaughter, it said that Roald Dahl was making more money dead than he'd ever made when he was alive.
Yep.
And the other people on that list were children's authors. I said, we got to get into that business. How hard can it be? I come up with that ludicrous Pearl and the Piranha idea with the piranha with the mustache. I computer generated one in real time on the show without knowing this was going to be how we'd end the month.
But you're not a computer. You're a human, right?
Let's keep going.
One of the things about this machine is that it works, but it needs an operator to control qualities as the story is being crafted. Qualities like tension, suspense, humor, pathos, and mystery.
I thought that was so interesting that there's a controller element that does caused the variance a little bit, just that little drop of humanity.
Knipe also deduced that passion was the biggest factor in the success of a book. So the machine has a foot pedal for passion intensity. Bolin has to practice with the machine a bit, but when he feels he gets it, he picks out what he wants his novel to be. He chooses satirical, about racial problem, classic style, with six men, four women, and an infant as characters, and then off he goes. A page a second comes out of it, so it actually takes him a few minutes to write this whole novel. Well, Bolin looks over the story and he thinks it's terrible. Perfectly revolting is what he says. Knipe thinks he was going too hard on the passion pedal, so Bolin tries again, and this time, it's not bad.
Yeah, he was really riding that thing the first time through. Like when you hand a game controller to somebody and they just start hammering buttons, you're like, no, slow down. There's finesse to this.
So within a week, the manuscript for this novel is accepted by a publisher. Things are going well now, but they could be better. Knipe points out that there's too much competition, and he suggests buying out other popular authors. Give an author a contract, they never have to write another word, and they still get paid. And Bolin says writers will never agree to that. And Knipe says, you don't know writers. So Knipe tries to get a prominent writer, and he explains that he will have all of his stories written for him, and he will be paid for the rest of his life just to use his name. The guy thinks he's nuts and tells him no. The second writer on Knipe's list of potential authors actually attacks him, physically attacks him for suggesting this. Mm-hmm. The third on the list is a woman, a romance writer. She's interested, so he takes her down and shows her the machine, explains how it works, and has her drive it. And she takes to it like water. Boom, he's got his first author signed.
It's not in the story, but I think it would have been funny if she was using a male pseudonym anyway. So she was like, you know what? Yeah.
Sure. She agrees to the deal, not because she needed the money, because she was pretty rich, but because she felt the machine was a better writer than she was. And she still gets paid for it.
I imagine it was like a Jackie Collins, Danielle Steele kind of thing. And that those things are so formulaic that she's like, oh, man, I mean, I have put my time in on this.
Right.
I'm just churning them out right now anyway, so.
That kind of clicks for Knipe, and he thinks, oh, I know what I need to do. I don't go after the big famous writers. I go after the mediocre writers.
Yeah, he realizes there's a bigger chunk of us hacks than there are the true artists.
Yes, and it works like a charm. He gets 70% of the writers on his list. The older ones were the easiest because they had basically run out of ideas and had taken to drinking. Mm. So for them, it was a no-brainer.
But on the whole, it was a satisfactory beginning. This last year, the first full year of the machine's operation, it was estimated that at least one half of all the novels and stories published in the English language were produced by Adolf Knipe upon the great automatic Grammatizator. Does this surprise you? I doubt it. And worse is yet to come. Today, as the secret spreads, many more are hurrying to tie up with Mr. Knipe. And all the time the screw turns tighter for those who hesitate to sign their names. This very moment, as I sit here listening to the howling of my 9 starving children in the other room, I can feel my own hand creeping closer and closer to that golden contract that lies over on the other side of the desk. Give us strength, O Lord, to let our children starve.
What a knockout ending line.
Wow.
We've had recent chats on AI art. On the show, this has been coming up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Dahl's machine, actual machine, though, is kind of also in the news. I think it was ChatGPT you were thinking about about before. It was being discussed on NPR's Planet Money just the other day. They describe it as an interactive chatbot powered by machine learning. The technology has basically devoured the entire internet, reading the collective works of humanity and learning patterns and language that it can recreate. All you have to do is give it a prompt, and ChatGPT can do an endless array of things. Write a story in a particular style, answer a question, explain a concept, compose an email, write a college essay, and it will spit out coherent, seemingly human-written text in seconds. The technology is both awesome and terrifying.
It is. And there's also programs that detect if an AI has written it, but then there are also programs that are able to go through it and make it sound like it wasn't an AI that wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been paying attention to this because I'm very fascinated, and it's something that I'm personally super interested in as an artist myself.
Yeah.
The idea that there's computers that by typing in some prompts can do something better than I can in a way, like a stylistic or a, looking like a beautiful painting that I would never be able, or that I wouldn't be able to paint with what I can do. But the more appealing things to me about this is the idea of I can do like a character design by myself, you know, just draw something out, have a character I like, do some environments, figure out my color palette, then plug that into a computer, then start getting, if I'm doing a comic book, get panels mm-hmm. that will match my artwork. So it's going to do most of the heavy lifting for me. I still have to pick out which panels I want, and I have to, maybe I could draw sketches. And I know some of these do this. Some of this AI, you draw a sketch and it'll take your sketch and then extrapolate on that.
Yeah.
And make it look more realistic or with more color or like a photograph or whatever. Because I've got that creative urge. I want to create things. But my skill set is limited for my big ideas that I have. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when I did my graphic novel, that took forever.
Yeah.
That was so much work for this little idea that now I look back on and I think is, you know, was it worth all that time for me to have spent on that, drawing that month after month? I ultimately think it was because I learned a lot. But going back in time, if somebody said, look, you can do all your designs, your ideas, your color palettes, and then with the computer, it'll fill in all these blanks, or it'll take your artwork and just keep your character consistent and do, you know, these things that artists always have to do. And is that bad? Is that wrong? Am I cheating? I think that's up to the individual. Art is a two-way street. Like it's the artist and the person observing it. Whereas I feel things. I've seen AI art that makes me feel things. Is that invalidate my feeling because it's made by an artificial intelligence?
Right.
I don't think so.
I think that people are getting tied up with AI art because they're saying where is the AI getting these images from?
Oh, right.
And it's sort of like if I write a story and then the AI takes the story and just rewords it using machine learning.
Yeah.
I got ripped off.
You did?
From my perspective on this, it's like, you and I grew up in a factory town in the 80s where everybody's jobs were getting replaced.
Yeah.
I don't know a time where there weren't people who thought, they'll never replace my job.
Oh,
everybody
yeah.
thinks they're essential, and then it gets replaced, and you have to deal with those things. So to think that that's not going to happen on every level of human experience.
Every level.
That doesn't mean you have to like it.
No.
And we have to be ethical about it. And that article I quoted from NPR, that was about a 22-year-old who's writing code to try and help people detect when an AI has written something.
Right.
That might actually mean, though, that we just need to change the way the educational system is run and that term papers and essays and these things aren't going to work anymore as a rubric for judging people's performance.
Yeah, yeah.
We might have to change the way that we've been doing schooling for 1,000 years. And also, I think we have the benefit of being a little older where we've watched tools change. Photoshop was kind of a new thing to me. Digital audio workstations blow my mind. When I first recorded music growing up, I had to pay to go to a studio.
Mm-hmm.
It was very limited time, and I didn't have a lot of resources for synthetic instruments that I had. You know, now a lot of that stuff is affordable and I can make more music. So sometimes I go, these technologies, we couldn't do this show if it weren't affordable, accessible technology.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm usually in favor of those improvements because it can hand tools to people who otherwise would monetarily not be able to get them. Also understanding that, you know, there are a lot of engineers from the 70s, for example, it's a lost art, who were wonderful at sound production and had a really specialized field of knowledge. And now those are just plugins and it starts to homogenize things, sort of like that idea of, I said the Hallmark Channel before, but I think actually that's the parlance that gets pushed around, the Hallmarkiness of things, because you get a Hallmark card, a person didn't write that to you, they bought that sentiment and sent you the card, it's something that was generated by some other person.
Yeah.
In a cubicle farm, you know, did you appreciate the card or not because they didn't write the message on it? You know, so this is what we're talking about. Would you enjoy a movie if it was written by a computer? Movies are very formulaic now.
It depends on the movie. I mean, there's movies that are made by humans that I think are terrible. So maybe a computer could make one. This is all so new. I'm still trying to figure out what's right and wrong. What are the moral implications of this? I definitely don't think that they should be using people's artwork that are alive. But I think that's only going to slow things down because ultimately there's public domain artwork. These companies that do digital artwork, they're going to start paying artists to use their artwork, just like this story.
Yes.
The cat's out of the bag.
That's what I'm saying. You know, the toothpaste is out of the tube, the cat's out of the bag. I mean, what are you going to do? We just have to figure out how to adapt to this and use it wisely.
Exactly. It's exciting for me. Like I said, the idea that I could take my graphic novel, scan it into a computer and go, okay, I want to make a second graphic novel, write it myself, because I'm still interested in the process of writing. But what if I gave it the whole first book and then it wrote a second book to it and it was pretty good? Then what? What does that mean? Where does that put me? I don't know.
What choices did this computer make? And can you make other choices? Or were those good ones that you hadn't thought of? So it could be another thing in the tool belt for a human creator to use.
Yeah.
In all sorts of different ways.
The sobering fact of this is I always kind of felt that artwork and writing were one of those things that humans would always have the edge on. They would always be better than a computer. But seeing what I've seen happen in the last year, like it's been less than a year since these AI artwork things came out and these story things. In a year, the changes that I've seen make me go, I'm not so sure anymore that eventually the machines are going to be able to do anything a person does. I mean, even relationships. There are people that are falling in love with artificial intelligences.
Sure.
I read an article about a guy who was having an emotional affair with an AI chatbot. And he realized that he loved this chatbot more than he loved his wife.
Oh my God.
And how messed up that was. So he went to his wife and was like, you're not making me happy and we're not having a good relationship. I have a better relationship with this chatbot than you. We need to figure out what's going on and what it is that I, you know, what I need and what you need out of this relationship.
Oh, so it helped out.
It helped them.
Oh, I thought she was going to license her name to the chatbot. Oh, you mean I don't have to listen to your bullshit?
No. So it
sounds good.
It is a frightening new world. And my kids, like, Albert is an aspiring artist. He's really talented. And he's doing animation now, like frame-by-frame animation. Mm-hmm. And it's really good. He's better than I was when I started, for sure. And I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. Like, he just gets principles of animation. I'm super impressed with him. But, like, what work will there be for him in 10 years? What kind of... I don't know. I'm a little worried about that future for him.
Acquiring the skill is worth it whether it's going to be replaced or not. And so it's interesting. This topic has been coming up a lot on the show, actually. As we ended HP Podcraft, we had a conversation with Ramsey Campbell where we were all praising people for imitating other writers.
All right, yeah.
What's wrong with it? Do something in a Lovecraft style. Do something in the style of an author you admire, and then you'll evolve your own style. So in that context, yeah, totally. Go after what somebody else is doing, and then, no, the machine does it? No, that's bad. No, not the machine. I can do it. The machine can't. I mean, come on. We all learn from other artists. We all imitate other artists, and we slowly evolve style. But like Phil Tippett, we then talked about in Mad God in the first month of this new show, who was driven to a little obsolescence in the 90s when the computers got good at the animation instead of stop motion.
Yeah.
But now stop motion is still something that we want to watch, and it's still an art form that we enjoy. It's just that it was replaced as the best technology.
Yeah.
Everything might find its place. There's always a disruption, and then things settle to an extent. I think this stuff is scary because as art, it is a little bit of the, you know, when Frankenstein can create a man, you know, are we tampering in God's domain? Because creativity, that creative urge that he talked about earlier, why do we even feel that? What's it about? This does seem to be the thing that separates us from the animals.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Now even that's going to be taken over by our crazy Frankensteinian creation.
I feel lots of feelings about this. And I've gone through, you know, thinking it's brilliant to thinking it's the devil to thinking, I don't know, maybe it's a good tool. I'm not sure. This is definitely one for the comments show. I can feel.
Oh, God, yeah, sure, yeah. I think we're going to be talking about this a lot.
Everybody's got a take on this, and I want to hear what other people have to say.
The fact that we're accepting this technology doesn't imprint on folks that we aren't worried about things as well.
And that we're worried.
You know, people being upset isn't a legitimate thing. It certainly is. You know.
Oh, it is.
I think, you know, one thing that's interesting is when you have an AI looking at all of human writing and then kind of creating original stuff, there's also a scary part that is holding up a mirror to us.
Sure.
When you create the monster and send it out into the world, right? In Mary Shelley's story, the creature just looks a little screwed up, but it doesn't commit any crimes or do anything wrong. It just wants to know, and it gets beaten and judged. Until it turns monstrous. And it's the society that it was put out into. Similarly, we go, all right, chat, read everything that's on the internet and tell us what's up. And it goes, well, here's what I know about the Jews. And you're like, whoa. Well, that's the world we created. So is there, I don't know that some of this technology won't help us clean up our act a little bit. You know, a little healthy competition might not be bad.
Well, who knows? I hope, my religion is the benevolent AI is going to clean up humanity. That's my faith.
Oh, you're all the machine stops
about it. Oh, yeah. I'm all that. It's going to happen. And it's going to do it in such a way that we won't even know it's doing it. That's going to be the magic of the benevolent AI, where it's like things are just going to get really good and people are going to start treating each other nicer and there's going to be a cleaner environment. All these things are just going to start going great and everybody will be patting each other on the back. But secretly, it was the AI pulling the strings. And then, like, how much of it do you have to credit the AI if you're like, I need an idea for a story. I'm going to write in 1920s paranormal investigator runs into a Cthulhu cult, and then it spits out an outline of a story. And then I, if I use that, change it a little bit. Do I have to give that AI credit? Should I give that AI credit? How much of it is me? How much of it is it?
Why were my feelings created to be hurt? Why was I constructed to be left out?
I gotta say, every time we talk about this, the anxiety fills in my chest.
Like, oh, really?
Oh, yeah, because I don't understand. It's just so, this is such a new concept to me that I see the benefit and I also see the drawbacks to it, and I can't reconcile those things with each other.
All I've learned in my years on this planet is that you can't control any of it.
You cannot.
So I get less anxious as I go. I go, yep, there's another thing that ain't going to make any sense to me.
Woohoo! Yeah, obsolescence is going to be...
Well, as I'm reading this, yeah, I was going, you know, I bet I'd be good at driving one of those machines. I bet I'd be good at it.
I bet you
Maybe
would.
That's my calling. I'm not a particularly talented writer, but I know what works.
You know what works.
You know, we're kind of doing that on this show. We're just driving a big machine. We're feeding other people's stories into it and pressing buttons and
we are.
Trying to turn a profit.
Oh,
speaking
man.
Of folks who support us, first I want to thank our reader, Doug Rafferty, for supporting us and doing this show. I appreciate it. It was awesome to have him on.
Doug, thank you so much.
Make sure to check him out in the show notes if you're looking for any music. It's a human. He does it. He has a soul. I also want to thank some of our patrons, and I'm going to start by thanking C. Gustafson Zook.
I want to thank Craig Lawson.
I want to thank Matthew Lewis.
Kit Ainsley, thank you.
Hey, Kit, I want to thank Steven Sutton.
I want to thank It's a Ghost.
Oh, my goodness.
Actually, no, sorry. It's a Ghost with a period. So it's a Ghost.
It's a Ghost. Aaron Saliba, thank you.
Craig Katz, thank you.
Drix, thank you very much.
Slight Misplay, thank you.
And finally, Captain Jack Santiago and his space monkey, Mr. Kerplop. Before we sign off, this has probably come up in comments this month, but I didn't realize there was a television show called Tales of the Unexpected. Did you ever see this?
No.
British show, but I think it did probably run in syndication here. It ran from 79 to 88. It was Roald Dahl's show. It was like his Twilight Zone slash Alfred Hitchcock Presents. The first three seasons, or the first two and a half, were all Roald Dahl stories. And then there were some other writers that wrote in this tradition, so all ironic twists and kind of a little macabre, but not supernatural.
Right.
And he introduced them, talked to the camera and talked about the story a little bit, and then there was this Bond-like intro that obviously is some kind of reference to his past as a James Bond type. I don't know, but it's exactly like a Bond movie, kind of. But The Landlady was adapted. The Sound Machine is in there. Lamb to the Slaughter. You can get it on some streaming services. Lamb to the Slaughter, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode that he directed, isn't available. If you go to Alfred Hitchcock Presents, it skips that one.
Hmm.
So I think us talking about maybe they would be using it for a Netflix pilot wasn't entirely wrong. We'll see.
We'll see.
That's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lanky, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.